Patrick Cox here with
Nina Borzuki.
And this is The World in Words. And this week, global swearology.
I love that word.
And grandmothers speak. And there's a connection. We've got an interview with swearologist Stephen Dodson and author Marilyn Chin, plus a little surprise.
I love surprises.
Oh, that's a good thing. Nina, do you have a favorite curse word from around the world?
Patrick, how about this? A curse word I learned from my grandmother.
Oh, that's the connection already.
Exactly. How about that? Okay, so growing up, I would hear this word all the time. She would say cholera jasna, which is a Polish word. And apparently it's actually not too terrible of a swear word, but it's sort of like, may you get cholera or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Cholera jasna. And so she would say it all the time. I had no idea what it meant, but I knew it was like something bad happens and you're like, cholera jasna. So I would start using it. And then one time when I was in high school, I had a Polish friend and she started cracking up because she's like, do you even know what you're saying? And I was like, no. There we go.
Those are always the best swear words,
it's
right?
Really,
if you
good
don't
swear.
Know what you're saying.
Exactly.
Well, I'm not sure if I do have a favorite swear word myself, but I have a least favorite swear word, which is a Danish one, and it is also disease related.
Oh, those are the best.
It's a disease that is around much more than cholera in the Western world these days, so that's why I don't like it. It's kraftirmai, which means cancer devour me.
Oh.
It's just horrible.
And
of course, Danes don't think about that when they say it. I mean, they say it all the time.
But it's like they reflexive, though. Cancer devour me, not like cancer devour you.
Yes,
so if you say it, it's just like, cancer devour me. Like, I'm so mad at myself, almost.
No, they would use it as the F word. So they would just say, that's fucking awful, or that's fucking great. Dear cancer, oh my God, that's really good.
Uh-huh. That's like cancer devour me.
That's cancer devour me good.
Yeah.
It's harsh. When we're surrounded by people speaking this foreign language that we didn't grow up with, we actually think about the words and what they mean much more than the native speakers. And so that always used to freak me out and make me think that Danish people were really harsh, which, you know, they're not. They're not thinking about, they're not
cancer
conjuring up those images. Well, apropos of all of this, we're going to start with an interview with Stephen Dodson. He's a blogger. He's the swearologist. His blog is called languagehat.com. And in a podcast that we ran about a million years ago, so I'm sure none of you have ever heard it or can't remember it, he spoke with reporter Lisa Mullins.
In every language all over the globe, people swear. Sometimes the terms are colorful, and what a surprise, sometimes they're just plain vulgar. Stephen Dodson has been speaking and studying languages and how to curse in them his entire life. He grew up overseas, the son of a foreign service officer. Now he blogs at languagehat.com, and he's co-authored a book called Uglier Than a Monkey's Armpit, The Best Put-Downs and Invective from Around the World. Stephen, why?
As you say, all my life I've been fascinated by languages, and to me, cursing represents freedom and the sort of basic human impulses that get sort of harmlessly expressed in language rather than bashing each other over the head.
Okay, yeah, I guess usually harmlessly. Now, is it so harmless to say uglier than a monkey's armpit, and in what context would you say that?
Right, that's a Spanish curse. It's more of a humorous insult than something that would lead to a bar fight, I think.
And the monkey reference? I mean, any particular reason why monkeys would be...
Oh, haven't you ever seen a monkey? Pretty ugly. No, it's... I think half the fun of an insult, of a well-crafted insult, is the sound of the words rather than the actual physical image involved.
A little like poetry.
Exactly. Actually, I think curses are a compressed form of poetry that's available to everyone.
Could you color a map according to the subject matter of put-downs?
Yeah, that's a great question. Their curses are very regional. There's a belt across Europe where the buttocks and defecation is the main, the preference for cursing. German is a classic example of this. But farther east, it's not much of an issue. In Russian, they don't really use that much. It's much more sexual and the sexual organs, and that's true across much of Eastern Europe. And then in the north, in Scandinavia, they still have a fair number of religious swear words. In Holland, the Dutch, for instance, hang on to the disease form of cursing, which used to be very common in English. We used to say, a pox on you, a plague on his house. And we don't anymore, but they still do in Holland, oddly enough. And in Quebec is a famous example of religious curses that are still the basic element of cursing. Damn used to be very powerful in English. It's not anymore. But in Quebec, the main curse words are still the Catholic church terms like calice, chalice, tabernacle, tabernacle. These are very powerful swear words, and it seems funny if you're not from there.
I don't get it. I mean, why would chalice be a swear word or tabernacle?
Because it's in a strongly Catholic environment, which Quebec was until very recently, those words are the powerful ones, the ones that carry the full weight of that emotional force. I mean, cursing is all about emotional force. And religion used to be the main source of that in people's daily lives. So talk about God, the sacraments, the cup that holds Christ's blood. I mean, these are extremely powerful images in the Middle Ages and, you know, in societies that kept the religious culture. Whereas in societies that sort of went through the Enlightenment early and kind of got away from religion as a basic force of communal life, to say damn you no longer carried that powerful force of that's a terrible, terrible thing.
Do new curses, new swear words develop after certain geopolitical events, such as in the Balkans, the war in the Balkans, or communism coming to and petering out to a certain extent in a place like China?
To some extent, I think it's more a matter of words going in and out of fashion or becoming offensive. Now, an example having to do with Japan and China, an old Japanese term for China was Shina, and it used to be a perfectly neutral word, but around the time of the Second World War, I think, it became highly derogatory. And nowadays, if you say Shina in Japanese, it's considered an offensive ethnic slur. And there's a guy I know who lives in Japan told me about a phrase, bakachon kamera in Japanese, which is a compact camera, and it's bakachon is clearly the English word vacation, rendered into Japanese. But it happens that baka is an extremely offensive Japanese word meaning fool or idiot. I remember it well from growing up in Japan. And chon is an insulting term for Korean. So if you happen to like that sort of thing, you can say bakachon camera, and it sounds like, you know, you can say, hey, it's just bakachon, it's just vacation. But you are enjoying the fact that in a sense, you're also saying stupid Korean. And I think that's one way that politics and swearing gets mixed up.
Is there a language in the world that doesn't have curses?
Not that I know of. I speak subject to correction from those who know, but I've been interested in this all my life. And the basic things of cursing, it seems to me, and one reason I like it so much, is that cursing is anti-authoritarian. The powers that be don't want you to curse in the same way they don't want you to go out and protest. They don't want you to rock the boat. My favorite example of this is Russia, which, as far as I know, of the languages I know, Russian has the most vivid, wide-ranging, and powerful vocabulary of curses. But if you just read the literature, Russian or Soviet, you would never know because you were never allowed to print those words.
How does a swear word, though, become sort of a marquee swear word, you know, the most forbidden?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, that's an excellent question. And swear words are this is an interesting thing. They're held in a different part of the brain than ordinary vocabulary. Neurological studies have shown this. And people with aphasia who can't speak, can't say normal sentences, can still curse.
Wait, why would that be, though?
That is strange. It's strange and very interesting. And it arises in the most primitive part of the brain, the oldest part, that language originally grew out of swearing, that the first things we said were curse words. But it's certainly, it's very ancient and very primitive, and we need swear words in some sense. We have to fill that space one way or another. And that's why when one kind of swear word declines, another comes up. So that if you forget how to say everything else, you will still remember that word.
That's Stephen Dodson. Again, the book he co-authored is called Uglier Than a Monkey's Armpit, and his very fine blog is languagehat.com. And before we leave Stephen, there's this.
One of my favorite anecdotes about swearing doesn't involve any actual curse words. It's a story that is told by Mark Lieberman, a linguist, in his blog, Language Log. He talks about a conversation between 3 4-year-olds in the back of a car. One of them says, "Do you know the bad words?" "Yes, my mom says them all the time. Mine too. I know the S word." "Don't say it, don't say it. That's the worst one. We'll get in trouble." "I'm going to say it. Stupid! There, I said it. No, you can't say that. Don't say it again." And as Mark says, they're preschool had a strict rule against calling people names, and stupid was high on the list. So, for these kids, stupid was a swear word. You couldn't say it, but they knew it. So when you tell somebody you can't say that, and this is the ridiculous thing about trying to prohibit cursing, when you say that you can't say that, that's forbidden, that puts that word right into that primitive section of the brain that holds the taboo language, so that if you forget how to say everything else, you will still remember that word.
Don't call me stupid.
Oh, right! To call you stupid would be an insult to stupid people! I've known sheep that could outwit you. I've worn dresses with higher IQs, but you think you're an intellectual, don't you, ape?
Support for The World in Words comes from Babbel. So maybe you want to learn a language for an upcoming trip or talk to friends and family, or you just want to learn a language because you want to learn a language. Now you can do it with Babbel. They have short 10 to 15 minute language lessons, and you will be able to do all sorts of things like say hello, order food, ask for directions, talk to a friend, anything you want to do. So I downloaded the app and I am trying to learn Polish. Surprise, surprise. And it's been really fun. So I've got the app out now. I am matching some of the phrases to the Polish word. So how are you? Jak się masz? So let's see if I got it right. How are you?
Jak się masz?
Yes! I got it right. It's so easy. You can do it on your phone. Just a few minutes every day and you're learning a language. And now, all of you listeners to The World in Words, you can get 3 months of Babbel free. Yes, that is free. When you sign up for 3 months, all you need to do is just go to babbel.com/world and use the offer code world. So that's babbel.com, babbel.com/world.
Nina, I know that you spoke about your grandmother earlier and that curse word she taught you. What is it again?
Cholera jasna.
Oh my God. I'm not going to try and say that. I can't remember any words from my grandmother, at least bad words.
Not at all?
No, neither of them. Actually, they died very young. And I don't think either of them really used bad words around me. Or if they did, I was too young to notice. But, you know, judging what my relatives had told me, it does seem as though each of those women had their moments and had pretty salty things to say.
Right.
It does seem like salty language and grandmothers go together.
I know, isn't that strange?
you know, even the big show's Marco Werman, we talked to him about this.
My grandmother, who's Dutch, was Dutch. She died a few years ago. When I was a kid, maybe about 5, 6, 7, I started hearing this phrase, and I would hear it when my mother, who was also born Dutch, she and her mother would converse, and this phrase, Godverdomme, would always come up. And I could tell by the look on their face that it wasn't a good thing. Well, I later found out that it was the equivalent of, well, GD. Just darn it, like the worst kind of darn it you could ever, like, express. And I began saying it. And then my mom told me at one point, look, you really shouldn't say that in front of your grandmother because it's really pretty bad. I later found out that, you know, wasn't so bad for me to say it in front of my grandmother. There were lots of other phrases that she actually taught me that were far worse. But so, you know, thank you so much for those dirty words in Dutch, Grandma. Oma.
Marco Werman there, host of PRI's The World, our radio show.
Yeah.
And now, Nina, I have a surprise for you. I'm going to enlist your grandmother again.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, this is a story about another word she taught you.
Oh, no.
And you remember it also happens to be your very first story that you did for the podcast.
Oh, no.
All the way back in 2009.
I'm sort of afraid to hear myself from that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, and I should say, this is not a bad word that she taught you, but a word that has stuck with you and now me. Nonetheless. So here you are back then.
Dawka is a Yiddish word that my 83-year-old Polish grandmother has exclaimed at me my entire life. Roughly translated, it means to do something out of spite. My grandmother defines the word as
just because. Because I don't want you to do it, and you Dawka do it to me. That's the explanation of the word Dawka.
Now, I've always thought that Dawka was a Yiddish word, but according to Michael Wex, a native Yiddish speaker and author of 2 books about Yiddish, Born to Kvetch and Just Say Nu, Dafka is neither a Yiddish word nor a Hebrew word.
It's originally actually it's Aramaic, technically. So really it went from Aramaic to Hebrew to Yiddish. So I'm sure if you ask the average Israeli today, they'd just tell you, oh, it's a Hebrew word.
There are many words that have crossed into Yiddish from Hebrew, from Aramaic. Words like Shabbos, which is the word for Shabbat or the Sabbath, and punim, which is Yiddish for face. The basic meaning and use of the Hebrew word dafka, according to Wex, doesn't differ much from its Yiddish iteration.
You could say in Yiddish, it's gotta be dafka azoy, this way and not any other way. But usually that's used in a sort of ironic, questioning way. If somebody says, if you walk through that puddle, that's not just a puddle, but that's an acid rain puddle, and your feet will burn off if you walk through it, you say, well, I'm going to dafka walk through it. That means I'm walking through it anyway, despite any warnings that you might have given me, despite what your opinion might be.
In some ways, this word seems like the epitome of Yiddish.
It's the kind of mindset that you will find with an unpopular and embattled minority.
It's that stubbornness.
Yeah, which you need, you know, to be the kind of minority that Jews are, where you could get out of it. You know, you could convert. That kind of screw you attitude has kept the Jewish people going. The language is a reflection of the way the people who spoke it lived. I mean, I guess any language is, but Yiddish more so, because, you know, many of the people, if not most of the people who spoke Yiddish, were able to speak something else. So why did they need a language of their own? And, you know, there are a number of sociolinguistic reasons for something like this, but one of the things is Yiddish really reflected what they couldn't say to people from outside the Jewish community. You know, thoughts and feelings that were just not acceptable.
So dafka, they'll speak in their own tongue.
There's a perfect use of it.
Well, that's dafka, an ancient expression which encapsulates centuries of oppression and the mindset of an entire people. Okay. This fails to impress my grandmother, who instead reminds me of when I was 5 years old and decided to jump into a puddle. Mind you, there was no acid rain involved. However, she did warn me.
Don't go with your shoes in the puddle, but just because I said it, dafka, you did it.
Wow, it's really nice and very strange to hear her because she has dementia now, as you know, which for several years, actually, and rarely speaks English anymore. So it's like kind of delightful to hear her speaking English. But that is a whole other podcast.
Right. Do check out the one about Nina's grandmother and dementia and language. It's really interesting. Podcast episode. We're going to end this archival edition with another interview involving grandmother speak. It's with poet and novelist Marilyn Chin, who herself had quite an interesting grandmother. Marilyn is the author of 4 volumes of poetry and a novel. The novel is called Revenge of the Mooncake Vixen. It's a little difficult to describe because, well, it's an awful lot of things. It's a coming-of-age story about 2 twin daughters of immigrants. It's also a series of fables, very poetic, and it's a classic American immigrant story. And many of the scenes take place inside a Chinese restaurant. Marilyn and I spoke a few years ago. So you grew up speaking Cantonese first and then English?
That's right. My first language was actually Toi San Hua. It is a sub-dialect, Toi San dialect, of Cantonese, which is the Hong Kong dialect. So there are many languages and many dialects spoken in our family, in one family, so that the child had to, you know, switch languages and switch dialects depending on whom she is having a conversation with. So when I'm talking to my grandmother, I speak in her dialect. And when I was in school, I would speak in Cantonese. And in those days, Mandarin was non-existent. I was born in colonial Hong Kong. And the nuns tried to teach us English, but I was too young to really absorb English. So I learned English when I got to the U.S.
So you got to the U.S. and you were speaking Toi San Hua with your grandmother and English outside of that. What were you speaking to your siblings?
We spoke in English. Now, it's very interesting about my siblings because I'm the oldest, so I still have the language now, most of it. But my brother, for instance, the youngest one, he could barely speak, you know, a few words, and he would grunt. You know, my mother would ask, "Are you hungry?" He would say, "Mm." You know, he would, he couldn't, for some reason, formulate the words to make entire sentences. That's the process of assimilation. The vector only goes one direction. It's very difficult to rediscover it. You have to take language classes and go to the homeland, right?
Absolutely. And it's not as if it's Mandarin, which is much easier to come across. And
that's right. And I just came back from Beijing, so I sort of patch up various dialects and languages and try to get through the day. After a while, though, I was able to figure things out. And it's really wonderful to have a second language or a third language, whatever. Americans, I think, are monolingual, which is too bad. This global world, we need to know more than one language. We need to be trilingual, quadrilingual, or something.
How has that affected your poetry and your writing, just being able to speak? I mean, you say that you can't describe yourself as bilingual, but certainly understanding a huge amount of another language. Has that affected some of the choices that you've made when writing?
I worked hard at retaining my Chinese, so I went back to Taiwan and Hong Kong, and my undergraduate degree was in classical Chinese literature. I knew that as a poet, I wanted to have the richness of two literary histories, and so I worked very hard at it. It's about making those images and puns and having two worlds collide on the page.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of natural for drama and confrontation, among many other things, if you've got both of those going.
That's right. It's about the oppositional forces more than a melodious force. You know, it's about two worlds rubbing against each other, sometimes in a violent, wild way, and sometimes in a melodic way. I like those confrontations. I like the hardcore, the edges. I like to test the edges, the sublime and the ridiculous, the sacred and the profane.
And there's plenty of that, sacred, profane, everything, in The Revenge of the Mooncake Vixen, which makes turning the page, I mean, you just don't quite know what's going to happen next. In the book, your main twins in this, Mooney and Mei Ling, they're both fantastic characters, and they both seem to be sort of different sides of a similar coin. But, you know, as you catch them in their teenage years, they both hate their restaurant jobs. And Mei Ling, especially, is just completely uninterested in fulfilling the basic tasks involved. And all she wants to do is be young and American, to get high, to get laid, which she does an awful lot. And you know, and then also you have the grandmother character who, like her granddaughter, she has this kind of archetypal side to her, domineering matriarch. Totally terrifying. And then there's a bit toward the end of the novel where the adult Mooney tries to banish the ghost of her grandmother.
That's right.
And
that's
she just keeps hearing her grandmother in her head. She hears her grandmother's archaic dialect, her, what was it? Toisanhua?
Toisanhua. Yeah, you're very good. You're Chinese, really. It's wonderful. Your intonations are great.
Her archaic Toisanhua dialect. And she describes that dialect as hard on the ears, as, these are your words, cacophonic, accusatory, downright malicious and abusive. And reading that, it sounded to me as though the language and the person being described have just merged into the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give you an example. She would used to say, "Li nui, li nui." And that, the THL, whatever.
What does that mean?
It means it's a curse. It's like dead girl, dead girl. And when you hear that, it's terrifying. It is a curse that is said a lot in peasant society, in peasant families. And then I stopped her once and I said, "You must stop saying that, because it is a terrible curse to talk about death, to say death to your grandchildren." She says, "Oh, well, that's an expression we use all the time. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean anything." But
That's great. So, wait a minute. You're now talking about your own grandmother, not
my own grandmother. My own grandmother,
who's
yes.
Clearly quite a model for the grandmother in the book.
Absolutely. She was a cleaver-wielding grandmother. She used to sit on the milk box with the cleaver, you know, and she used to chase away our boyfriends. And then we would try to find another hiding place two blocks away, and she would find that hiding place, and she'd run screaming, yelling with her cleaver. She was mad. But
was she as unsuccessful as the grandmother in the novel in protecting the maidenhead of her granddaughter?
That's right. She was very unsuccessful. Yeah, we were wild girls. We lost our virginities very young. We smoked pot. I used to hitchhike up to Vancouver to rock festivals. She couldn't keep the lid on our maidenheads. That's for sure. She tried very hard. And so those expressions, I guess our mothers, our parents' voices will forever be embedded into our brains, right? But my grandmother, her voice, she haunts me in my dreams. Yeah, she'd come in and into my dreams and curse me for this and that. It's just, I guess it must be guilt But she had a wild tongue.
Can you give me a couple other examples of her toisanhua?
Oh, some things I can't even say because, oh, they were so terrible. But she would say, "Ni hui naya, you hui la? Hui naya? Where are you going? You're going again?" And the tone of the up and the sing-song, and that would sort of funnel into my ear. She would also, she knew a lot of tongue twisters, and there's one that goes like this: "Dong dok dok sai dok 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 dao bak gok mai ling gok hok dui mun cheng gok lo." And so there's all these.
Wow, what does that mean?
It's like, oh, you run to the east, you run to the west, you run to Mongok, which is a place in Hong Kong, and you buy ling gok, which is a kind of nut, and then it's hard to translate, but it's rhyme. You know, it's fast delivery, it's tongue twisting. It's really wonderful. There are a lot of these tongue twisters I remember, and some of them I don't even know what they mean. So very young, I got into puns and singing and rhyming. So that's why I became a poet, because her voice and the voices of those first 7 years of my life were prominent in my brain. Somehow they entered the soul in a deep way that really transformed into poetry.
Writer Marilyn Chin. And that's all this week on our archival adventure into grandmothers and swearing. There's got to be a good joke in there somewhere.
There sure has to be. Tweet us your grandmother's favorite curse words. We're at LingoPod, and I'm at Porzuki.
And I'm at Patrick Cox. Thanks so much for listening.